thanks for inviting me, and I appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you all about what we're doing in Florida relative to the 4Rs. Just a little bit about the Office of Ag Water Policy. We're a unit of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, and our responsibility is to work with the agricultural industry in Florida on water quality and water quantity issues. So we have a staff of about 51 people scattered around the state, and we work directly with the agricultural producers, and then we work with the five water management districts in the state and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. The water management districts are primarily responsible for water quantity issues, and DEP is responsible for water quality, and we're sort of the middleman between those agencies and agriculture. And as you know, if you watch the news in Florida at all, for any length of time, there'll be an issue, there'll be a water issue. The water's on the front page pretty much every day. So there's a lot going on in Florida, but there are some specific things I want to talk to you about and how 4Rs can make a big difference. So just a quick overview. How many folks here are from Florida? Okay, so some of this may be news to you. Florida is a large agricultural state. About 25% of the state is in cropland or ag production. We have about 50,000 farms. The economic impact is, you know, $8 billion in products sold, but an economic, you know, multiplier of $120 billion impact. So it's the second largest industry behind tourism. And it's a, you know, so a very important part of the economy. It's also a part of the economy that's under a lot of pressure for a lot of reasons. One, of course, is that as the population grows, they're projecting a population in Florida, you know, approaching 30 million in the next few decades. So we're going to, we have, when I moved to Florida, in the 70s, there were 6 million people here. So it's just exploding. And that puts a lot of pressure on land use, of course, but it also puts pressure on the water resources that are available for agriculture. There's a lot of demand for water. Fortunately, in Florida, we have some pretty good laws. The legislature was foresighted enough several decades ago and continuing to build some laws that protect water quality and water quantity, and put in place some mechanisms that allow the various interests in Florida to work together, and they have to work together, to figure out some solutions. One of the solutions that the legislature adopted and implemented is the use of agricultural best management practices. We actually have, in law, a definition of best management practices, and we also have a process for developing them and implementing them. And these are the specific, I don't know, do folks get this? Do they get a copy of this?
Since it was uploaded, I think they can access.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm not going to spend a lot of time citing the section of the law and that kind of thing. But the thing to recognize is that the best management practices are established in Florida law. There's a mechanism for developing and then adopting them, and actually the Department of Environmental Protection has to verify them. So they do what's called an initial verification. So we work with the stakeholder groups, the university, agricultural groups, and put together a set of best management practices. Then they are reviewed by DEP, initially verified, and then they're adopted by rule. Once they're adopted by rule, agricultural operations have the option of implementing them. There's no requirement that agricultural operations implement these BMPs, but it's an option that they can take advantage of. If they do that, if they enroll in our program and implement the best management practices, they're given a presumption of compliance with water quality standards. So unlike in some states where you get a letter of regulatory certainty for some period of time, agricultural operations are actually protected in the law for if they implement the BMPs. They're given a presumption, and there's even a prohibition from DEP taking action against them, or initiating action, I should say, if they're in our program, they implement the BMPs. The one wrinkle of this, though, is that one of the things DEP does is identifies impaired water bodies. Once they've identified a water body that's been impaired for one of the water quality parameters, they develop what's called a Basin Management Action Plan. And the Basin Management Action Plan is the, you know, the hydrologic boundary of that particular water body, whether it's a stream or a lake or a spring, in our case. And within that designated Investment Management Action Plan area, producers have to make a choice. They either have to implement the BMPs, or they have to demonstrate compliance with water quality through monitoring. And the monitoring has to have a plan to, you know, approved by DEP, and so it's essentially you become a permitted facility if you decide to monitor. So far, we haven't had anybody decide to monitor. Everybody, you know, once they realize what's going on, go ahead and they enroll in our program. There's no fee to enroll in our program. We actually provide technical assistance, and we even have some cost share dollars we can use to help implement BMPs in these areas. We also, of course, partner with NRCS with their EQIP program. The water management districts also have cost share dollars, which they can use, and we work with them to develop that too. So far, we've got, I took out the slide, sorry. We have 9 separate sets of BMPs covering the various sectors of Florida agriculture, vegetable and agronomic crops, nurseries, dairy, poultry, cow-calf operations. And there also, I should mention too, there's a set of BMPs for forestry operations. The forestry operations are really large in Florida. They cover a significant amount of land. What we've been doing for the last 2 years is going back into the BMPs and reorganizing them into 3 categories: nutrient management, irrigation management, and environmental resource protection. The environmental resource protection has to do with preventing runoff and erosion to water bodies primarily, or protecting wetlands. But the one we want to focus on today is nutrient management. And I've told Sally and Laura about this a couple times, I think, now. We were in the process of developing these nutrient management BMPs and organizing them, trying to make them, you know, in some kind of logical fashion. And we were saying, well, you know, what we need to do is we need to have a BMP that talks about what material to use. We need a BMP that talks about when to use it, a BMP that talks about where to use it. And we had, that's the 4 R's. So what are we doing here? Let's just use the 4 R's. So we just decided to go all in on the 4 R's. And so the 4 R's are in our BMP manual. And we're in the process of working with the stakeholders here in Florida and the Fertilizer Institute and the Nature Conservancy, as you mentioned, to get the 4 R's to be more of a prominent feature in nutrient management in Florida. So that when folks who are in the nutrient management arena are thinking about recommendations or thinking about fertilization, they just automatically think of 4 R's. It just needs to be the way it is, and that's what you do in Florida, is you do 4 R's. So just to give you an update where we're at, so we have an active program to enroll agriculture producers in best management practices. And all this is on our website too. If you want more information, you always go to our website and look under Ag Water Policy, and we have all these maps and everything available for download there. But this is our statewide enrollment as of March. We haven't updated it because we're going back and doing some data cleanup to make sure that it's more accurate. Land use databases in Florida change all the time, and so we're spending a lot of time cross-referencing different databases to make sure they're as accurate as possible. But as of the end of March 2017, we had close to 11,000 enrollments, and that represented about 40,000 discrete parcels. So an enrollment is a producer, and a producer may have more than one parcel, obviously, enrolled. And we enroll about 1,000 a year in our program with the work we're doing. I told you about the Basin Management Action Plan. There are 30 of them that are either adopted or being developed. Once they're adopted, like I said before, the producers have to either implement the BMPs or demonstrate compliance with water quality through monitoring. Roughly south of Orlando, the water quality impairments are for phosphorus. Because it's primarily a surface water system. You have a lot of lakes and some rivers. North of Orlando, roughly, it's a nitrate impairment. And that area tends to be a karstic environment, and you have a lot of springs. We have, I think, 1,000 springs in this area. And that's where you have the nitrate problems. So our program, you know, for the southern part of the state, we have to focus on BMPs relative to phosphorus control. The northern part of the state, we have to focus on BMPs that relative to nitrate. The big thing that we're looking at right now, and that's coming down the pike and will be a major activity before the end of the year, is a BMAP for the Suwannee River Basin. The Suwannee River Basin has a huge number of springs. I'm not even going to try to give you the number because I'll get it wrong, but there's a lot of springs. Pretty much all the springs are impaired for nitrate. The soils are sandy in the karstic environment, a lot of agriculture, and we're going to have to spend a lot of time changing the nutrient use practices for the agricultural operations in that basin in order to achieve the water quality standards that we have to meet. There's a lot of public pressure on agriculture to improve water quality. That manifested last legislative session in a couple bills that were introduced to essentially regulate fertilizer and require farmers to report their fertilizer use. We pushed back pretty hard on that. They weren't adopted, but they'll be back. We have a session coming up in January, and we're pretty sure they'll reintroduce that legislation. The fact is, most of, you know, Florida population doesn't know much of agriculture, and they look upon agriculture as in effect a polluting industry. And so we have to change that mindset and push back on it and demonstrate to them that farmers can produce food economically and profitably without having a negative environmental impact. And we're making progress in that area, but we got a long way to go too. And the 4 R's are going to be a big part of that. So is David Royal here? Should be. He better be. We have a partner here with the Nature Conservancy. They have a person who's working full time on getting the 4R principles implemented at the grower level, and we're taking his program and trying to expand it with some of the staff we have. Okay. Well, I'll stop there. I think that gets the point across.
Right. We'll have time after the next three quick graduate student presentations for some questions and discussion with all the speakers. All right. All right, so next up we have Bethany Walters from the Virginia Tech University, who's going to present to us about nitrogen response.
Good morning. So I am doing my PhD research at Virginia Tech, and I have a cover crop project where I'm looking at a lot of different things. We're looking at nitrogen inputs to the system, but I also have some soil health measurements I'm doing. So I want to share some of the research that we've gotten from this project so far. Cover crops are often encouraged for farmers who want to improve their soil quality and their soil health. And I think, can you see this on the slide? Yes, so I have some preliminary some soil quality data. We measured soil compaction after 2 years of cover cropping. And the, there we go. The red line shows the compaction in the conventional till plot, which doesn't get very compacted till below 6 inches, whereas we transition to no-till, which is the blue line, we have a lot more compaction in the top 6 inches. But the green line are the cover crops, and so when we added cover crops to our no-till soils, they helped to decrease some of this compaction, so they're kind of intermediate between the two. So we're already seeing soil health, soil quality improvements with cover crops. But in order to get all these benefits, you need to try and add as much cover crop biomass to add a lot of carbon to your soil, which is great. But when you do that, you need to also realize that when you add a lot of carbon to the soil, you can't have really high carbon nitrogen ratios. And this will kind of change your soil fertility dynamics, and you can have immobilization of nitrogen, which means that you might need to add more nitrogen to your soil. So this is a diagram of our big overall experiment, and today I just want to talk about what's circled, which is our cover crops and corn crops in year 3. So we've been growing these cover crops, and this year we added some 4 different nitrogen applications. So we're adding no nitrogen, 50 pounds, 100 pounds, then 150 pounds of nitrogen to all these different treatments. So I want to present some of the data of the corn yields from those different experiments. So this graph shows the corn yields and for all of the 12 different treatments, which some included cover crops. The ones with the solid lines were cover crop treatments, and the ones with the dashed lines were the 4 different no cover crop controls that we had. Across the bottom of the graph, there's the 4 different levels of fertilizer, going from the lowest of 0 on the left to the highest, 68 on the right. And these are, on this graph, it's presented in metric units, but for those of you who are familiar with US units, the rates are 0, 50, 150, 100, and 150 pounds of nitrogen per acre. So, what happened to the yields when we added different rates of nitrogen to these cover crops? The cover crops, with the exception of 2 of the cover crop treatments, the red line, which is the one of our diverse mixes, and the blue line, which was a 9 species mix, all the rest of the cover crops had higher yields than the controls. And this was especially evident in the ones at the top, which all of these treatments up here had a lot of legumes in their mixtures. We also saw that when you went from no fertilizer to 50 pounds of fertilizer, there was the greatest yield increase in my corn yield. But there wasn't a big difference between going from 50 pounds to 100 or 100 pounds to 150 pounds in the cover crop treatments. In the ones without cover crops, we did see a yield increase as we added more and more nitrogen. But what we didn't see, and what I really expected to see, and what I hoped to show you, because it would have really emphasized my point, is that we didn't see a big, we didn't see that there were cover crops treatments that needed more nitrogen to overcome this nitrogen immobilization. So why that was? These are the carbon nitrogen ratios of all of my different cover crops in my experiment. The highest carbon nitrogen ratio in our experiment was just almost 14 to 1. The average was about 11. For those of you who remember your soil fertility, immobilization, mineralization, the cutoff between those two is somewhere between 25 and 30 to 1 for carbon to nitrogen ratio. So if you're lower than that, you're going to have more likely to have mineralization, and you would have nitrogen available to your plants. If it's higher, then you would have immobilization, and you might have nitrogen deficiencies. So this year, we had very low carbon nitrogen ratios in our cover crops, so I don't think we saw the immobilization that we expected to see, which was good. But in other experiments with cover crops, a lot of times you do see this immobilization, so it's kind of disappointing not to be able to make my point about what I want to show you. So some of the things that I want you to remember from this research is that cover crop yields can increase your corn yields compared to no cover crops, especially if you have cover crops with a lot of legumes and a lot of biomass. And that we did see an increase in yield even with small amounts of nitrogen fertilizer applications. We'd hope to see a greater yield increase with more nitrogen applications, and that might be the case when we were able to produce more biomass than we did in our experiment. So we have some issues with our cover crop mixes. And also but I guess what you really take from this research is that you should consider the nitrogen, contribution or mobilization if you are using cover crops for fertility and for soil health when you're doing your fertilizer recommendations, because it's really easy to have mineralization or immobilization. Okay. So this research was funded by the NRCS, and I had a lot of help at Virginia Tech and the Eastern Shore AREC. I don't think we have questions now.
We'll do questions at the end.
This is a picture of one of my very good cover crops, which could potentially have mineralization, but we didn't study it in that year. So.
Alrighty. Thank you, Bethany. Up next, we've got Elliot Carver from Kansas State University.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Elliot Carver, and today I'll be talking a little bit about my research focusing on phosphorus fertilizer placement and cover crops and their impacts on phosphorus loss in a no-tillage corn-soybean rotation. So this research, as the title says, we're looking at phosphorus fertilizer placement. So we looked at a surface broadcast application of phosphorus and then a subsurface injected application of phosphorus fertilizer as well. And we looked at these two fertilizer treatments, both with and without cover crop. We also compared that to a control with no applications of phosphorus fertilizer. To monitor phosphorus loss from the field, each one of our plots has been fitted with an H flume. And so basically each one of our plots are graded to be their own watershed. So they all drain through a focal point. We're able to collect a composite sample whenever we have a runoff event. And that flume can be seen on the left-hand side of the screen. That's the white box. And I don't know if I can get over there. Okay. But that's just kind of a brief insight into my research. I won't go too much into methods. I'm just going to cover some of the findings that we found. So we found, for this presentation, I'll talk about our 2016 and 2017 data. So we are in a corn-soybean rotation. So 2016, all the numbers correlate to soybean. In 2017, it all correlates to corn. So in 2016, we found that the use of phosphorus fertilizer increased soybean yields by about 10% compared to the control. And in 2017, we did not see a statistical difference in crop yield for corn, but we did see a trend of adding phosphorus fertilizer is going to increase our corn yield. For total phosphorus loss in 2016, we found that for both years, applying phosphorus fertilizer increases our phosphorus loss from the field. The fall broadcast application in 2016 increased phosphorus loss compared to the control by 1.5 times. And in 2017, the fall broadcast was 3 times greater than the control, and the spring injected was 2 times greater than the control. We saw the same trends in total phosphorus as with dissolved phosphorus. So again, in 2016, the fall broadcast application had 3 times as much phosphorus, the dissolved P loss from the field compared to the control, and the spring injected had 2 times as much compared to the control. In 2017, similar trends with fall broadcast having a higher amount of dissolved phosphorus loss compared to the control and compared to the spring injected. And what's interesting over these past 3 slides, you've seen that applying phosphorus fertilizer is increasing our loss from the field. But if you notice, there's a difference between the two methods. So when you put the phosphorus fertilizer on the surface, you're getting more loss than putting it below the surface. This correlates with our 4R of placement. So just a little thing to think about there. Now just talking about cover crops, in 2016 we found no statistical differences in yield with no cover and in cover, but in 2017 we found that our cover crops actually decreased our yield by 36% in corn. We don't have a quantifiable measurement on this, but what we did find was when we planted in around April 20th, April 24th is when we planted, we had a triticale cover crop before corn, had a lot of biomass, we had cooler soils, wetter soils, we had a little bit slower emergence for the corn. And it just kind of seemed like most of the corn in the cover crop plots just dragged behind. There's just a little maturity lag there. We also got a pretty big drought in the summer, and it seemed like maybe the cover plots had taken up a little more water. But again, we don't have a totally quantifiable measure on this. We also found that cover crops increased the amount of dissolved phosphorus loss from our field. In 2016, we found that cover increased dissolved phosphorus loss by 54% compared to the no cover plots. And in 2017, cover crops increased dissolved phosphorus loss by 75% compared to the control. Now, while the cover crops increased the amount of dissolved phosphorus loss from our system, we did find that they had a very significant decrease in sediment loss compared to the no cover plots. In both years, we found that using a cover crop would decrease the amount of sediment you lose by 70% compared to no cover. Thinking back on the dissolved phosphorus, so we found that when you use cover crops, you might have a greater amount of dissolved phosphorus loss compared to the no cover. But this kind of makes sense considering you're losing less soil particles from the field. So you have less soil coming off the field that would have your bound phosphorus, so you'd just be losing the stuff that's dissolved. So some conclusions from this research is we found that application of phosphorus fertilizer increased crop yield, and that subsurface injection of phosphorus fertilizer had less phosphorus loss than surface broadcast. We also found that cover crops increased dissolved phosphorus loss, but however, they significantly decreased total sediment loss from the field. That's all I have. All right, thank you.
All right, and our last, she's going to be really rapid, she tells me. She's got 28 slides for her 5 to 7 minutes, is Kirsten Workman from the University of Vermont, who actually is under my old PhD advisor.
Awesome, thank you. So I don't follow instructions very well. I have more slides today for my 5-minute presentation than I did yesterday for my 15-minute presentation. I'm a certified crop advisor and an agronomy specialist with UVM Extension. I put that first, and then I'm also a master's student in plant soil science with Dr. Bosworth. I'm actually going to talk to you guys a little bit more today, not so much about the results of my research, but the actual results of working with farmers and what that research sort of has leveraged. So the first thing is it's really based on strategies. So, you know, meeting, and all of you know this, raise your hand if you're a CCA. Okay, any producers in the room? Great, so you guys all know this. And then the researchers? Okay, good. So I really appreciate meeting farmers really where they're at and fitting into their system instead of making what we're trying to do, them try to fit into our system. So sort of meet them where they're at, remove the barriers, assess the challenges, and try and address those. So anyone from Vermont knows this individual. He asks the hardest questions on the planet. You can see by my face. And so sometimes you're just trying to keep up with the producers and figure out what are they doing and why does it work. You'll see him later. So for me, soil health has really been a great way for farmers to get a little bit more excited about for our nutrient management. So I work with farmers a lot on their nutrient management plans. I've never had a farmer like text me a picture of them implementing their nutrient management plan, like breaking out the binder, right? But I do have farmers now texting me pictures of earthworms in their no-till cover crop cornfields. And so that's where I'm seeing them get a concept that they really are excited about that translates to I'm doing a better job for the environment and I'm also doing a better job growing my crops. That's a picture of Lake Champlain with an algae bloom, which is one of our major issues in Vermont. So this picture, I'm just going to talk about the areas that we do research. And when I say research, I mean true scientific research, but I also mean just demonstrations on farms where we collect data. This picture actually is me with our little 10-foot no-till grain drill. And if you look carefully on the right side of that picture, you'll see a 30-foot no-till grain drill that the farmer is using. And that, to me, is just a picture of we had these drills, we bought them, we put them in the hands of farmers, they used them, they liked them, and then they made it better, right? They got the 30-foot wide one because it goes a lot faster and does better. So we deal with forage nutrient management. We look at cover crops and no-till truly as a system. We also look at crop rotations. Manure is a huge thing in Vermont. We have mostly dairy producers, and now we're even starting to do research on tile drainage and the impacts of some of our practices that are coming out of tile drainage. So small plots are important. We do that. I don't have a research station that I work out of. All of my research is on farm. That's a Google Maps picture of my master's thesis research and the CIG project next to it. It's exciting when you pull that up. And then we had farmers say, small plots are great. We love that data, but I want to see big plots. So we started doing bigger plots, big things you could see next to each other. And then we really started doing other things like whole field comparisons or splitting a field half and half. So this is a planting date, winter rye experiment. And luckily I work with a fantastic group of producers called the Champlain Valley Farmer Coalition. And I have a ready-made group of 85 plus farms in 3 counties that I work that literally this week when we were putting together a grant proposal, I drive in the dooryard and say, will you sign this letter of support? And they're like, yeah, whatever, sure. And they're sort of all in, and they give us their equipment, their land, all of it. And I don't want to forget about the basics. As CCAs, we deal a lot with, basic agronomy and reminding our producers about the importance of that. This is, my research plots. I've spread manure, and we measured manure applications, but it really brought home to me the point, like, oh, right, we should really be calibrating our applications of nutrients so that we really know what we're putting in our nutrient management plan. This farm, in his nutrient management plan, that he was putting on 5,000 gallons to the acre in the fall. Well, when you really measure it, it was more like 3,500. So that has pretty big impacts on your nutrient management. Partnerships are wicked important. This is one of our custom manure applicators. He's done a lot with us, and he's obviously here injecting in a cornfield. But also, we've worked together, and we do this also with our seed dealers and our fertilizer dealers. We were able to get a grant together to purchase this piece of equipment to look at injection in grassland, where we're actually seeing more potential for phosphorus loss sometimes than in our corn systems. And then you have to sort of be the risk taker, right? So both that piece of equipment, this is a field that got no-till, roller crimped rye, planted corn. You know, farmers on their own might not be willing to take that risk, although often they are. But really, I feel like our role is to be able to try it, measure it, quantify it, and then tweak it before the farmer has to apply it on their land. So we do that by testing an idea. This is me and some research plots where we were looking at an interseeding cover crop, 10 different mixed, you know, sort of project. And then took it sort of to the next level, right? We're trying to look at, I call this charismatic megafauna. So helicopter seeding cover crops get lots of news coverage. And really this was the beginning of cover cropping as sort of a wave in Vermont. And although we don't use the helicopter all that much, it's just one of the tools in our toolbox now, it's really what got producers sort of started and excited about it, and now we have other ways. So my colleagues up in the northern part of the state were able to get this interseeder, and again, you know, farmers not going to buy a helicopter usually, or this giant piece of equipment, sometimes, not in Vermont, they haven't done it yet, but trying all these things before they make those major investments. And then what we've heard from our producers is local, and when I mean local, I don't mean Vermont, I mean Addison County, Vermont, or Chittenden County, Vermont. They want local research on their soil types and their farming systems with their neighbors, and you know, often we don't even see them travel very far. Oh, I'm already over for 5 minutes, we're gonna go. I'm gonna just go through this to show you. We do lots of research on farms. We get results. That's important. But really for me, right, this is the goal. So this picture is in my master's thesis research plots. We always have a field day. This is a very small group of farmers that came. We were talking to soil scientists, the producer, we were talking about the project. The take-home message was drilling cover crops is better than broadcasting. And there was one farmer in that picture who left there, and the next fall planted 30 acres of cover crop. And he told me, it's not because you told me, Kirsten, because I know you want me to plant cover crops. It's because he went to that particular farm, so identifying a producer in the area that people are really curious about what they're doing and know they are a good grower. And he said, if they're doing it, then there's probably something to it and I should try it. So we planted 30 acres, and then we ended up doing a really awesome project. That roller crimper rye picture was from his farm, and we held another field day out there the next year with 40 farmers. So just, you know, that one takeaway for me is an indication of success. And you can just see there in the last 5 years, we've seen huge changes in Vermont. Farmer buy-in, I've talked about, really important. That's really what drives the system. And then as CCAs and service providers, I feel it's really important. It's our role to celebrate success. So this is our Champlain Valley Farmer Coalition winning the National No-Till Innovator Award at the National No-Till Conference in St. Louis last year. I nominated them for that, and they deserved it, and they won it. Also, helping our producers share the story of agriculture. We've heard this, you know, all week, I feel like. There's big pressures, and this is Gerard telling the NRCS state conservationist on the bottom left there just exactly how much manure he injects. She was a little surprised, but we guaranteed her met his nutrient management plan. And that's a Middlebury College student asking Gerard if he's organic and him explaining why he's not. And another bus tour of a young lady, and that is her nutrient management planning binder, but just talking to folks about impacts on small farms and regulations. But for us, the end goal, this healthy soil for our nutrient management nexus, is where it really leads to healthy crops. And for the community, it's healthy watersheds. And at the end of the day, this farm, now that they're implementing soil health practices over the last 10 years, is having, you can't tell, but that's an extension on their bunker silo. They had to add more bunker space this year in a really challenging cropping season in Vermont. And they're no-tilling, they're cover cropping, they're following the 4 R's. So that's the goal.